KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, Context, Culture, and Connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I'm from Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland, California.
Coming up, the story of how Japan gifted cherry trees to the U.S.
And those second shipment of trees are the ones that were planted around Washington, and their descendants are the ones that still bloom every spring.
How that story was connected to the country's immigration debate.
The president thought, well, maybe this is a way that we could show respect toward this country at the same time we're closing our doors to immigration from them.
And how the immigration debate had strange parallels with pests and pesticides.
Because, you know, it could be on their clothing, it could be in their pillows, bedding. They fumigated everything, including the immigrants themselves.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Have you ever flown or driven into the U.S. and been asked to declare what fruit you're carrying?
How you doing, ma'am? Are you carrying any plants or produce?
No.
Okay, have a good day.
That question is part of a whole system to prevent insects from coming into the U.S. from other countries. Insects that could destroy our nation's crops. This week, we've been airing a three-part series about bugs and borders called Operation Pest Patrol. Today, in our last story, we're going back in time to hear about the history behind this system. We're still talking about pests, but what we're really talking about is people. Because it turns out that the way we talk about and treat insects shows us something about the way we talk about and treat each other. Here's KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch.
I want to tell you a story about two childhood friends who had a huge fight over plants and bugs. The friends, David Fairchild and Charles Marlett, lived over 100 years ago. Fairchild was a botanist. He studied plants. And Marlett was an entomologist. He studied insects. So both scientists, but they had really different worldviews.
Fairchild was a pretty optimistic guy. He had a lot of luck in his life. He went all over the world and had great adventures, made great friendships.
This is Daniel Stone, who wrote a book, The Food Explorer, about David Fairchild.
He had a lot of success stories in his work and in his life that just fed this ego and ethos that it'll be fine. And Marlett traveled around the world with great struggle, and he saw the world as a disaster that needed to be averted.
Eventually, their worldviews clashed in front of the President of the United States and on the front page of the New York Times. It's a story that has to do with ladybugs, the cherry trees in Washington, D.C., and the way we think about our country's borders.
I think both knew that they were arguing at a small disagreement as part of a much larger national debate.
Out of that fight, huge policies and huge industries in this country were born. Which is all to say, the fight was about way more than just plants and bugs. Fairchild and Marlett meet as kids in Kansas in the 1870s. It's a grasshopper year, when grasshoppers emerge from the ground to mate. There used to be so many of them that they would darken the skies. Farmers hate them because they destroy the cornfields and apple orchards. Marlett and Fairchild spend the summer digging in the soil looking for bugs. Marlett is obsessed with insects. But Fairchild falls in love with plants. He loves reading books about faraway jungles.
Both of them grow up, and at first they set off on parallel paths. They both go to Washington. They both find their way to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
They get jobs there as scientists studying similar questions.
Fairchild through plants and what plants can we get that could be even better plants? And Marlett through how could we get rid of these insects?
At the time, U.S. farmers are mostly growing corn and wheat. So Fairchild gets hired to travel around the world and look for new crops that we could grow here.
He ends up visiting dozens of countries, going and searching markets and visiting farmers and asking questions in search of plants.
This is the U.S. in the late 1800s. More and more people move here. Cities are booming. The U.S. is growing like never before.
This is the era of American colonization, of getting Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, of America feeling that things outside that were valuable were its right, that it should have them.
And Fairchild becomes a part of that. While the U.S. collects islands, Fairchild collects pears and papaya. We have him to thank for so many fruits we now grow in the U.S., like avocados, mangoes, and peaches. But the thing is, these plants can also bring insects, and they can eat crops. And that's where Fairchild's childhood friend, Charles Marlett, comes in. Like, there was this one type of insect called a San Jose scale that was killing off fruit trees in the Santa Clara Valley. Scientists named the insect after the city where it's found, San Jose. But Marlett is convinced that the bug accidentally came from Japan, so he decides to travel there to find it.
And he takes his wife.
They just gotten married.
This is part of their honeymoon, to go hunting for an insect.
Honeymoon slash work trip. While they're there, she contracts an intestinal parasite, which she later dies from. But Marlett manages to find what he thinks is the natural predator of the San Jose scale, a type of ladybug. Remember, this is the era of ship travel, so Marlett has to care for a couple hundred ladybugs while crossing the Pacific. And by the time he gets back, supposedly only two are still alive.
Newspapers caught wind of only these two ladybugs left, and they dubbed them Mr. and Mrs. Ladybug.
This is like Ladybug Adam and Eve. The survivors rebounded, their numbers grew, and they are still found here in the U.S. today. But soon, Marlett and his childhood friend Fairchild start to argue. Fairchild wants to import all these foreign plants, and Marlett is worried the plants will bring in bad insects. Their fight becomes so heated, they end up facing off at high noon in the town square. Except it's the scientist version of a duel. They both write cover articles for National Geographic, arguing their case.
And Fairchild's was very rosy and optimistic. It was called Our Plant Immigrants. And Marlett's was very dour and pessimistic, and it was called Pests and Parasites.
Finally, their disagreement comes to a head over one particular crop. On his travels, Fairchild falls in love with Japanese cherry trees. They're beautiful pink blossoms that bloom every spring. And he gets this idea to import them to Washington, D.C., to beautify the nation's capital and to ease tensions between the U.S. and Japan. More Japanese people are immigrating to the U.S., but the U.S. keeps passing laws that makes it hard for them to live here. So Fairchild proposes the idea to President Taft, and he loves it.
The president thought, well, maybe this is a way that we could forge a friendship without any of that racial stress. We can have botanical gifts that don't take anyone's jobs and that show respect toward this country. At the same time, we're closing our doors to immigration from them.
Fairchild works with the Japanese government to import a couple thousand cherry trees. They're shipped from Japan to Seattle and then put on a train to D.C. When Marlett finds out, he marches into the State Department office and is like, over my dead body are those trees coming in. So the president orders Fairchild to inspect the trees, and Marlett insists on coming too. They go to the train station together, and Marlett finds 16 different kinds of insects that could potentially decimate crops in the U.S.
And Marlett is saying, oh my goodness, thank goodness I'm here. We need to burn these trees. We need to get rid of them.
And he gets the president to agree. They pile up the trees, meant to symbolize America's true feelings toward Japan, and they burn them all in a giant funeral pyre.
And it was done in a really sloppy way. It was done publicly, on the National Mall. Reporters were invited, and it was written about on the front page of the New York Times the next day.
Luckily, the Japanese government is very gracious about the whole thing. They decide to send another shipment of trees and enlist all their best scientists to help make sure that these are free of pests.
And those second shipment of trees are the ones that were planted around Washington, and their descendants are the ones that still bloom every spring.
Fairchild gets his cherry trees. Marlett gets to say, I told you so. They both sort of win this fight. But that same year, Marlett gets the president to pass a federal law that says from now on, we can't import any more foreign plants without them being inspected for insects first. In 1912, the federal government passes the Plant Quarantine Law, which allows the Department of Ag to inspect and quarantine plants and turn away infested ones.
That slows the process of plant exploration dramatically. It almost makes the process unworkable.
Marla and Fairchild's relationship never really recovers, and the quarantine law has stayed in effect through today.
That quarantine law is also the reason still today why when you get on an airplane, you have to fill out that form that says, I haven't been on a farm or I'm not bringing in fruit from a different country.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. And we're listening to the final story in our three-part series, Operation Pest Patrol. We've traveled back in time to hear the story of David Fairchild, the botanist who imported Japanese cherry trees into Washington, D.C. And we met his childhood friend, the entomologist Charles Marlett, who almost brought that whole plan to a screeching halt because he was worried that the cherry trees might accidentally bring in pests, insects that could destroy the country's agriculture. Their disagreement laid the foundation for our country's policies about importing plants and controlling for insects. Turns out, though, the story is about a whole lot more than just plants and bugs. Let's go back now to KLW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch.
Okay, I want to fast forward to the 1940s during World War II and show you something. Because this story is about way more than just plants and bugs.
There's a malaria prevention poster.
This is Jennifer Sedell, who researches food systems at UC Davis. She's showing me a poster from 1944. It's kind of like a public service announcement about malaria, drawn up like a cartoon.
And in it, you have Uncle Sam with his outstretched hands.
In one hand, he has a mosquito with a tag on it that says malaria. Back then, malaria spread by mosquitoes was a huge problem that made millions of people sick.
And in the other hand, he has the Prime Minister of Japan.
The Japanese Prime Minister during World War II and Pearl Harbor.
And the image of the Prime Minister is really a gross caricature, huge buck teeth and squinty eyes and wearing a swastika.
And Uncle Sam?
He looks super strong as he's holding up this decrepit-looking Prime Minister and this really giant, scary-looking mosquito. And over this image, you have enemies both. Eliminate them. It's your job to help eliminate them.
And the implication from this poster is that Japanese people and insects are one and the same.
But the conflation is even deeper than that because you can kill a fly, you can kill a mosquito. And if the person in front of you is the same as a mosquito or fly, then they're equally expendable.
How did we get to this place of blatantly associating people with pests? Some researchers, like Jennifer Sedell, look back to the turn of the last century, to this time period of Charles Marlett and David Fairchild, the story of the cherry trees and the San Jose scale and the ladybug. And these researchers say that when the country was arguing about borders for plants and insects, it was also having a debate about borders for people. And these two conversations weren't separate. They had some very dangerous overlap. Remember, in the early 1900s, more and more people were emigrating to the U.S. Think Ellis Island on the East Coast, Angel Island on the West Coast.
For centuries, it has been well known that epidemic diseases follow the lines of commerce and travel.
When immigrants arrived, public health officers inspected them for insects and signs of disease. If they showed symptoms, they were quarantined and treated.
As this happens to be a case of old world typhus fever, which is known to be spread by the body louse, the contacts are first taken to the delousing plant.
Sedell says that's where Marlett got the idea for inspecting and quarantining plants.
You've got folks saying, okay, when new people come to the U.S., and they seem sick, we either turn them away or we quarantine them. Why aren't we doing that for plants and animals? I mean, it was that explicit.
Down at the U.S.-Mexico border in the early 1900s, agriculture and public health agents were worried about insects coming up from the south. Lice that could cause typhoid or boll weevils that could destroy the cotton crops. And they worried that Mexicans crossing into the U.S. were accidentally bringing these insects with them. Here's historian Jeannie Shinazuka.
Because, you know, it could be on their clothing, it could be in their pillows, bedding. They fumigated everything, including the immigrants themselves.
This one young woman who lived in Mexico but worked in the U.S. got tired of having to take a chemical bath every time she crossed the border. One day she decided she had enough and refused. A bunch of other Mexican workers joined her and protested. They got arrested. The incident became known as the Bath Riot.
So I think it really starts to get at this issue of, well, really, who was the perceived pest here?
Shinazuka says in some ways the U.S. welcomed immigrants, but only for certain reasons. Chinese and Mexican immigrants were coveted for their cheap, hard labor. Japanese immigrants were exotified for their culture. And yet, the U.S. also singled out these immigrant groups as vectors of pests and disease.
And that was actually the same attitude that was directed against the Japanese cherry tree, that, oh, it's so beautiful, but on the inside, we don't know what's hidden on the inside of this packaging.
In the early 1900s, Asian immigrants were banned from owning land and restricted from living in certain places. In the face of that, many Japanese and Chinese immigrants in California became successful farmers, gardeners, and nursery owners. But then the USDA ended up blaming them for introducing insects, since they worked so closely with plants. Remember that bug, the San Jose scale?
I think that if they could have renamed it Chinese scale at that point, they absolutely would have. Because people knew that there was power in that name, and power in setting prejudice against the location and origin of an insect when you name that insect after the place.
Researcher Jennifer Siddell says that scientists chose names for insects to associate them with something that was already maligned.
So in the East Coast, I mean, the most famous invasive insect is the gypsy moth. So that's technically from Europe, but it's already, you know, relegated to a subgroup that is easily maligned and marginalized.
Where an insect comes from or what it gets named may not seem like such a big deal, but names and origins matter. Here's an example. American scientists found a beetle. They thought it came from Japan, so they named it the Japanese beetle. Then Shinazuka says the pesticide manufacturers came up with some very unfortunate brand names to match.
They would call it Japellant, Japicide, and Japex.
That's right, an insecticide called Japellant. I've seen the newspaper ads selling it, blatantly associating Japanese people with pests. And Shinazuka says associating people with pests is a very dangerous metaphor. It's really saying those people are not human. And when people are seen as inhuman, they're easier to eradicate. It becomes more than just metaphor. When World War II broke out, Shinazuka says our country borrowed an idea from agriculture and public health when we quarantined our own citizens in what were called internment camps.
Incarceration of Japanese Americans, right? I mean, you could argue that that actually is an ultimate form of quarantine, that we need to contain this population.
I'll give you another example. American farmers were using a chemical called hydrogen cyanide to fumigate the citrus trees and kill scale insects. German scientists took that pesticide and adapted it into Zyklon B. That's the chemical that was used in the gas chambers of the Holocaust to kill people. Here's Jennifer Siddell.
And this is really like one of those moments that just highlights how much casting a marginalized group or an unwanted group as insects can literally dictate how you're treating them.
Like she says, how Nazi leaders gave speeches equating Jewish people with lice.
And then the way that you're eliminating them is with a actual honest-to-God pesticide. So it isn't just that you're thinking of portraying them in a military poster or propaganda as insects.
It is way more than rhetoric.
It is how you actually make death possible for certain groups that you don't like.
This language, talking about immigrants as pests and pests as immigrants, it continues today. Think about the killer Africanized honeybee or the conversations happening about immigration.
These are not immigrants entering our country. These are individuals that are invading our country, and something needs to be done.
And they're coming in with diseases such as smallpox and leprosy and TB.
It's not a caravan, it's an invasion.
The president put it this morning on Twitter. Democrats are the problem. They don't care about crime and want illegal immigrants, no matter how bad they may be, to pour into and infest our country.
David Fairchild and Charles Marlett were a botanist and an entomologist. They were arguing about plants and insects, but their argument didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened right alongside the immigration debate. Ultimately, Fairchild and Marlett and the country as a whole were having a debate about borders. Who or what is native and who is invasive? Who or what is legal and who is illegal? Who is the ladybug and who is the scale insect? Who is the cherry tree and who is the pest? I'm Marissa Ortega Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is our science reporter. This is the last story in our series, Operation Pest Patrol. Go to KALW.org to hear all three stories. The series was made possible by funding from the 11th Hour Food and Farming Fellowship. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. If you're a regular KALW listener, you've probably heard our ongoing series, My Mixtape. It's a way to bring the Bay Area together. Folks we talk with share songs that have made a difference in their lives. Here's one of our favorites from this year. It's from a local musician about a song that reminds him of an idea he has about playing guitar, which is that you shouldn't try to emulate other guitarists. Instead, you should emulate other artists. Let's go.
You are listening to KALW's My Mixtape.
A mixtape, a compilation of specifically arranged songs.
1, 7, 2.
My name is Lou Gallardo. I play guitar and sing in Sweet Lou and the Sweet and Lows. And my mixtape is If I'm Unworthy by Blake Mills. It is, from top to bottom, like an insanely well-written song. And he's just like this virtuoso guitar player who doesn't flex that hard. And you can tell he's like pulling from so many different things.
Wasted.
It's layered perfectly. The words are perfect. His voice is perfect.
Life's just not long enough.
Yeah, it's been a shower jam for like a long time.
I'll wrap you in my arms, babe. See if they're strong enough. What if I'm unworthy of the power I'll.
Oh yeah, that song's in my regular playlist now. Thanks for sharing, Lou. That mixtape was produced by Kristen McCandless. You can listen to mixtapes from other people around the Bay Area or submit your own at KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast.
Over you. I'm unworthy of the power of.
The Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Sarah Nora Coast, Maggie McKay, Kevin McLean, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are Tarek Foda, James Rollins, and Gabe Graben. Shireen Adel is our content manager. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Our deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. We're listening to Moonshiner Collective, based down south in San Luis Obispo. They're headlining at Amnesia in San Francisco tomorrow night. Show starts at 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
Left battlefields and dying sounds, just hoping to be saved. Running freely through this wilderness, the night becomes our place. Is this day our survival road, lasting living for tomorrow? Oh Lord, thank you kindly. We have seen you in the red trees for the love of my life, for the sea and the sky, for the bonfire that awaits, and this place where we can find our way. Drifting further towards the waters as we close our eyes and sing. We felt the beach under our toes, we fell in love again. Sure good to get lost sometimes. I don't miss my friends. And it's time we promised everything, but who knows where it ends.